You know, Marx said that we are not ourselves when we work. And the way that urban construction and city planning is, cities are meant to alienate us from one another. They're meant to keep us pacified and consuming whichever lifestyle that they package and sell to us. So a new layer of alienation is added on top of the one that we feel from being alienated from the productive capacity that makes us human. So really, like, we're not ourselves when we work, but we are pushed so much further away from even being ourselves when we commute an hour to work every day in our cars by ourselves, like, hating and spitting vitriol at everyone around us merely for being there.
Right.
The society that we live in, specifically in, you know, the city built up in post-World War II neoliberalism, is an incredibly alienating experience that produces all kinds of mental illnesses that we haven't even tried to grapple with because we haven't fucking admitted that there's something wrong with it. Hello, and welcome to the Regrettable Century. I'm Chris.
I'm Kevin.
I'm Jason.
And I'm Jenny.
Today, we are talking about the right to the city and the necessity of rekindling a utopian vision for everyday life. So, let's see. What is the right to the city? It is a political slogan that seems to be in vogue in all left and left-adjacent circles these days. Anyone from do-good liberals in the UN to, you know, communists.
The right to the city, as at least as conceived by Henri Lefebvre, which is where we get the slogan, like an expression of the very, like, demands of the communist project, but also like a bread-and-butter demand for the day-to-day. The idea being that it says plainly what we want, but also begins to suggest the very means by which we might achieve it. So when Lefebvre's talking about the reconceptualization of rights within the framework of bourgeois society, like in the liberal conception of what rights are, he posits the right to the city as a challenge to the way that we think of not just what our rights are as, you know, as citizens and as people in a given geographic space in the urban centers, which are more and more they're the most important parts of capitalist society. But also that it begins to help us, theoretically helps us challenge our conception of where rights come from, because it's a thing you have to struggle for in order to achieve it. So it's like as if it was a transitional demand, and at least in Lefebvre's conception. What would it mean to have genuine participation in the construction of the city, which is to say, the immediate space that we traverse, not just where we work, but, you know, where we live, where we play, and the means by which we get from one place to the next.
I really liked the way that Lefebvre talks about the need to reconceptualize rights, because in studying medieval law, you deal a lot with the concept of natural rights and rights that are given by God, right? God-given rights. And Lefebvre argues that our conception of rights, the only rights that really, like, matter to us, are the ones that we can win for ourselves, and that we have to reconceive of the idea of rights on that basis. And it's not good enough to just say, well, these are God-given rights. These are, you know, these are natural rights. No, you know, rights are whatever we decide are rights and then win. So we can have a right just to exist in a city and have aesthetically pleasing cities. And
so, much like situationism, I feel like this is one of the things that has not really been taken up by the left in any meaningful way, outside of, like, anarchist spaces and circles. And I feel like that dismissiveness has set us back a whole lot. What I really appreciate about a lot of what we read to prepare for this episode, and definitely, like, Chris, what you were just talking about, is this way of reconceptualizing rights, I think, helps us kind of demystify a lot of the muck that we, like, live in and live with and under, right? And I know our brand is, like, revolutionary pessimism, but that there's, like, a sense of hopefulness when reading a lot of the stuff that we read to prepare for this. And so sorry for going off brand for just one moment, but but then so, which is to also say that, you know, when we talk about like what, you know, the neolibs and like the UN are, what they mean when they use the phrase the right to the city, I think we can begin to revisit a lot of our usual pessimism.
Well, also, like, if what passes for optimism is that once the apocalypse happens and we finally defeat the last of the fascist warlords in the wasteland and begin to establish, you know, socialism in the dried up, burned out husk of the desert wastelands of, you know, North America, that we will be able to read Henri Lefebvre and, you know, think of new ways to conceive of cities, then yeah, sure. I'll be, you can call me an optimist.
Well, it's funny.
Not to your face.
It's funny because in that environment, when we grapple with concepts like closing the gap between state and civil society, right? By like resituating the citizen within the realm of participation, like genuine participation and not like spectacular kind of passive contemplation, which are not Lefebvre's words, but I think that they're appropriate here. The very first thing we'll have to do is go like, wait, what's civil society? And in a sense, actually, in the neoliberal era, that we already kind of have a very dwindling conception of what civil society actually is. So I think it's also...
We have a romantic notion of civil society, and that's about it.
Yeah. That's why it's important that we also read Harvey as well as Lefebvre. Because Lefebvre's writing in the era of military Keynesianism, of the bureaucratically ordered society that the Frankfurt School is known for kind of like theorizing. Whereas Harvey's writing in the disintegrated post-bureaucratic world. I mean, that's not quite the right way to put it, but you know, in the neoliberal world. And I think that we need both because Lefebvre's kind of utopian and sort of abstract approach to like trying to decouple Marxism from the Stalinized versions of Marxism that he dealt with in the French Communist Party. And then Harvey's attempts to reassert class and class analysis and class politics in the era of like anti-hierarchical, horizontalist, you know, quasi-anarchist approaches to things like the right to the city. Like, I think we need both because we're dealing with the legacy of both of those incomplete projects.
Both of those monstrously deformed versions of what it is we're trying to do.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. And Harvey even makes the point in one of the pieces about critique of neoliberalism isn't enough, that insofar as we are critiquing a certain form of capitalism, we're left trying to, you know, recreate a better form of capitalism. And he makes the point that so long as we leave capital, you can have a better form of capitalism. We have had it in the past. But so long as you're trying to recreate that, you're giving rise again to the very problems that we're trying to deal with right now. But yeah, I think that the virtue of the slogan, you know, right to the city is precisely in its ambiguity, that like any effective political slogan is going to have a significant degree of ambiguity contained in it, because it necessarily has to be able to take root in people's existing ideology that is a product of the ruling ideologies, and then be capable of acting as a fulcrum to shift it in a different direction. And so, like, you know, tapping into the notion of bourgeois rights in order to get people to assert themselves in a certain capacity to create the existence of the political reality of a right as properly conceived in a Marxist sense, which is a thing that is only exists not by nature, but by self-assertion, by organizing to make it so, right? Like, that is what makes something a right, is if you have the power to demand and create it, that thus it is a right. Then, you know, so be it. So be it if we're appealing to bourgeois rights to do so.
What, like, but the right to vote, you know?
Yeah.
The right to a trial by jury, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, since we live in bourgeois process, society, since we live in bourgeois society, we gotta not pretend we don't, you know? And
the foundation of our whole system is based on post-Enlightenment thought and the necessity of bourgeois democracies to like build up the wealth and surplus that we will expropriate. So yeah, I mean, like, we're okay with using bourgeois things like their wealth to create our new society.
Yeah, exactly. And also, you know, I've heard it articulated before as well that there's a right way and a wrong way to critique liberalism, you know, bourgeois ideology. That, you know, one, the wrong way is to reject out of hand anything that could be classified as liberalism qua liberalism, because it is liberal. You categorically reject it in favor of something unstated. But exactly, and the correct way to critique liberalism is a much more like pragmatic approach to the critique that says, where are we confronted with the contradictions in liberalism that do not work in the class interests of working people? Where we confront those contradictions, there we oppose liberalism. But our entire working class project is given rise to by the ideology bequeathed to us under the bourgeois enlightenment. You know, like the notion of equality is a bourgeois notion, and we shouldn't just reject that out of hand.
So what Kevin is saying,
including rights.
So Kevin, no, what you're saying then is, we should be propagandist enough to utilize what moves people most.
Yes, exactly.
Beyonce.
And we're revolutionary pessimists, not a total nihilist, right? So
right.
That means that we have to be able to find God in the dark from time to time, or else it's just pure darkness.
Sure.
Also, we're pessimists, but that's pessimism is different than cynicism, right? And I think, shout out to that episode, go listen to it, on revolutionary pessimism.
Yeah.
shout out to us doing that episode.
So the conversation about rights, I think, is important, because it gives us the language to begin to grapple with, you know, this theory. But it's probably important to just get right out in the open, like from the beginning, that the conversation is more than just the ideal of expanding right and using the, you know, developing the imaginary in a utopian direction so that people think of themselves as subjective agents, because they should, right? Because for both Lefebvre and Harvey, and I think for Marxists dealing with the questions of urban space and of everyday life, that it's essentially, just like everything, an economic question, right? So, like, Harvey develops it a lot in the Consolidating Power essay, the Neoliberalism as a Political Project essay, and the Right to the City essay. But Lefebvre does in earlier essays, you know, they locate part of capitalism's present dynamism in finance capital and its and city centers as concentrations of capital, and you know, there's this whole way in which our everyday life is conditioned by the needs of capital in the urban center, so that like what we're really talking about is not just like, it's not an abstraction, it's intended to be a theory for how to respond to the way in which capitalism itself has changed in the post-war era.
I would like to get at what was mentioned just briefly earlier, where we talked about the idea of the critique of neoliberalism not being the where we end the conversation, where we end the critique, because there were obviously better forms of capitalism previously that were less exploitive for some people, and whatever, I guess Keynesianism worked better for large sectors of the society. Not for everyone, though. Of course, people of color were not doing super fucking great under the
But one could imagine a non-racist New Deal or Keynesianism that doesn't exclude a portion of the population. I think the critique has to be a structural one. It has to indict the very nature of the whole economic project itself. It has to point to this is an untenable project. it has to point to the reality of stagflation right. in the 70s that Keynesianism couldn't deal with, and thus gave rise to neoliberalism.
Well, and it has to also contend with the relationship between the right. core and the periphery, right? Like, Keynesianism in the core requires, you know, essentially what we call neoliberalism now in the periphery.
So the usage of the city and city planning as a method of stabilizing capital goes all the way back, in David Harvey's reckoning anyway, to Louis Bonaparte. And he shows examples of the way that France solved the problem of surplus capital and unemployment was to reinvest that into the rebuilding of Paris, and at the same time created the beginning of the modern urban center that we know now in all of its alienating forms. And he built gigantic wide boulevards for the military to be able to use, and basically helped create the situation that led to the Paris Commune by making everyone in the city of Paris so fucking angry about the way that their city was being restructured. Of course, there were other circumstances like the war with Germany and whatnot. But this project of oppressive urban planning that alienates the populace from its ability to live within the cities that they must live in goes all the way back to the 19th century. So if we're calling back to a better form of capitalism, we're going to have to... What are we going to do? We're going to go to the 18th century?
It's a pretty rough time then, too.
Like libertarians do?
Speaking as me, no. Thank you.
No. Well, so I think that is actually a really interesting... I think that's actually a really important place to start, because when, you know, Harvey's describing a pretty significant phenomenon in that he marries, if not the actual articulated slogan, the right to the city, it's the conception of urban space as a terrain of exploitation, of accumulation, and of resistance. It goes all the way back to the first working class government, which is to say, like, the proletarian revolution emerges in a form more than just working class protest, or even the demand for national workshops, like in 1848, but where the class takes complete control over all of its surroundings, not just the workplace, but of city administration, of armaments and defense, of food distribution, telegraphs, railways, everything, right? The world's first working class government was conceived of its own power in a totality. And if you think about, like, the Soviets in Russia, we talk a lot about workers' councils, right? Like in the factory districts or whatever. But the other Soviets were, you know, they were essentially... Yeah, neighborhood councils, right? You know,
right.
The consolidating power essay, Harvey points to the sort of lingering but never fully developed conception of the neighborhood as a space to organize on broader class lines than just, like, this is what life is like at work. But this is what it's like for everyone in the district. This is what it's like for, you know, we like to talk about intersectional feminism and the way in which, you know, Italian autonomists kind of started to deal with the question of unpaid labor and social reproduction. And the neighborhood council is a theoretical mechanism of organizing people on precisely those kinds of lines.
So I think, like, to bounce off what Jason's saying about Harvey's writing, he talks about reshaping processes of urbanization. And one of the phrases that he uses when describing that is changing the city to change ourselves. And I think that's such an important way to put that. It feels in a lot of ways like the flip side to the most annoying Gandhi quote of all time about, like, being the change you wish to see in the world, as opposed to, like, the potential for the world or the city in this instance, right, enabling us to actually change parts of ourselves, and that be like a cyclical relationship, and those things work like in conjunction with one another, as opposed to, like, as a contagion, right? And so I think that that's not a new way of conceptualizing the way change happens, right? But I think in this context, it is different than the way we say, like, people change in struggle and blah, 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 right? Mm-hmm. Those talking points feel very new and different in the way that we talk about, like, the right to the city, at least for me. And maybe that's just because this is, you know, I'm fairly new to trying to conceptualize what a lot of this means. So I think also, you know, in talking about changing the city to change ourselves, he talks a lot about how that requires different forms of organization, right? And I think when you talk about like neighborhood councils, that's A, super cool, and also very super important to me, right? So in the city where I'm from, the only neighborhood council that we have is in a historically black neighborhood called Hillcrest. And the neighborhood council, as far as I know, formed in response to the city's organization around industry, right? So initially, as a response to being in Refinery Row and the overwhelming impact that has had on that neighborhood as a result of the refinery literally being planned to be built by a black neighborhood, so that the impacts of environmental racism would be felt most among that community. We are literally a textbook city when it comes to environmental racism. Like, the history is disgustingly well documented in terms of what city planning looked like. So the history of that neighborhood council has been fighting the refineries, A, and then more recently has been B, in response to the port and the industries tied to the port, who, as of recently, the Department of Transportation has bought that entire neighborhood, essentially, because they're building a new bridge so that the industries that operate in the port can have a higher bridge to, like, take things in and out of. So all of those folks are losing their homes, most of whom are getting nothing for it because they're renters. They don't actually own anything. So, I mean, a lot of this, like, really hits close to home. And when we're talking about, like, these out-of-workplace struggles was, I think, the phrase that Harvey used, right? Because of, you know, the way things are, especially now when you consider, like, rates of unemployment, gig economy, right, undocumented labor, and then the amount of, like, alienation and mechanization that there is in the workplace now. Just, like, talking about organizing the way that we have, we gotta do more doper when it comes to that.
So,
hear, hear.
Yeah, you know, whenever I hear, so in my imagination, when most people hear neighborhood councils, because I live in Los Angeles now, the way I think of it is like LA is full of everybody in LA has a neighborhood council, you know, the Echo Park neighborhood council, whatever. And I think it's a very different thing than I think, hey, what you're talking about. And certainly a different thing than what, you know, what these, like, you know, Marxists are talking about as it relates to class struggle. Right. So I think separating these things out a little bit is probably important. Like, when I hear neighborhood council, I think of it in the same way that I think of factory council, but for the neighborhood. Or, like, you know, to make it more concrete, I think of, like, you know, in Venezuela, they have what they call the Consejo Comunales, the communal councils, which arose from the street level in their sort of early days of the Bolivarian Revolution, and came to take on more and more of the administrative tasks of their districts, in direct defiance and in opposition to the city councils, in a lot of ways, so that they became a parallel structures, and at their best, right? And these are the, like, when squatters would take over a building, and declare it, you know, they would declare it appropriated. It would be the neighborhood council that would codify that into some sort of protected status, like a new right. You know, they were de jure rights that were taken and then granted, right? And the way that you would be represented in the neighborhood council would be that you would be a part of a tenants union, or, you know, you would have a, you know, be working like a communal kitchen or something like that, right? So I think, in as much as we talk about bourgeois right as a starting point for motivating and providing context for how we think of things, Jenny, the way that you describe the neighborhood councils forming in opposition to developers and the league between developers and city administration, I think that's what we're talking about, right? That's at least the beginnings of you know, putting teeth into the notion that you could organize people on the basis of the space they occupy.
So, right, but that Harvey talks about a little bit about the importance of, you know, like this is, I think what Harvey, from what I can tell, this is what Harvey is talking about whenever he talks about this. This is the importance of reading Capital Volume 2. Everybody reads mm-hmm. Capital Volume 1, which is concerned with the productive sphere, and nobody reads Capital Volume 2, which is concerned with the realization of profit, the sphere of the realization of profit, which is the expenditure of wages rather than the production of wages. And the expenditure of wages specifically on the necessities of reproduction, the things that you need to be able to, like, reproduce yourself as a working class person, like mm-hmm. paying your rent and buying food and whatever else. And this is the sphere where social the theories around, like, social reproduction become relevant. But he makes the point that, like, Capital Volume 2 is this other incredibly important area of theorization that we need to engage with. Mm-hmm. That's too often neglected. But he also makes the point that, you know, in the productive sphere, the lines of organization are very, they're bright lines. They're very clear. Yeah. It, you know, do you own productive property? If no, do you have the ability to hire or fire? If no, there you are working class. Like it's real cut and dry and really clear. Who we are trying to industrially organize. In the reproductive sphere, things get a lot fuzzier and a lot...
Well, so I think, for one, when Lefebvre is writing, he's dealing with the existence of a mass working class movement with political parties and trade unions, right?
Right.
So that they have a conception of, like, state power. They have a conception of class relations at the factory floor or in the workplace more generally, right? And have corresponding political and economic organizations, institutions of the class to do combat either in defense or in advance of an interest. But what's under-theorized, under-utilized, and under-organized is the rest of life. So, like, I think... We should be really clear, or at least let's say the case that I would want to make personally is that this is not like a new, different terrain of struggle. It is not like to be counterposed with the classical battles of, you know, you and your boss. But when you think about how, especially in the era of atomization of life and of working life, that it's a necessary... Another conundrum that comes up in any conversation about, like, traditional left-wing approaches to the question of power is like, well, what if you drive for Uber and, you know, walk dogs for a job? Who's your boss? Right?
Right.
So, like, it's an element of how we conceptualize our role in society as a whole. And that, you know, if we have a conception of, like, democracy at work, everything from union representation all the way to, like, autogestion, right? Self-management. The right to the city is the extension of that concept into, you know, your utilities and public transit and housing and parks and local groceries and whatever. You know, the things that you, is to extend the conception of self-management, self-organization from the workplace into the home, into the neighborhood, and so on. Taken by itself, it just presents the old conundrum in reverse.
Yeah.
Yeah. There are blurrier lines outside of the workplace around which to organize.
Right, I see. Yeah.
Right? And there are fractured material interests that aren't mirrored inside of the workplace, aren't necessarily mirrored inside of the workplace. In light of that, how do we organize neighborhood councils that exclude the interests of homeowners, even though we are the material interests of homeowners, even though we are organizing neighborhoods of people who live in homes that they own, even though they're paying the mortgage to the bank?
Yeah, like, I mean, I think so. My really simple answer to that question is, like, you need a socialist movement, right? Like,
oh, okay, yeah,
like,
oh, in cool, it,
yeah, like, okay,
problem solved.
Let's do it. Let's.
No, like, if I was going to try to like bring this down to the, I mean, yeah, okay, like, I have tried unsuccessfully to bring this conversation down to the level of like the practical day to day tasks of being in a socialist organization and being in a socialist group, so that like, you know, you prioritize areas of work so that like we know that there's a need to unionize work generally. And you might even say that there's a specific need to organize certain sectors like the logistics industry, you know, the logistics, like the transportation hubs for goods and services. Similarly, even though we need a broad popular conception, which is to say that affects all non-bourgeois classes, right? People at various levels of various strata, we need a broad popular conception of the right to the city. There are specific targeted approaches that we should take, which have to do with which neighborhoods and who in which neighborhoods. And those would happen to be the people who are tenants as opposed to property owners. They would be people who are prospective tenants, people who would be tenants if they weren't having to sleep on the street because rent was out of control. And they would have to be tied to conception of jobs. So that, like, in addition to a jobs guarantee, which is a bourgeois right to a job, that would be a constituent element of the right to the city. Is like you would have a good job, you would also have a place you could live, and then you would also have the ability to get between the two, right, and so on. And actually, the more deeply you assess it, the more it necessarily points to the essentially capitalist function of city administration. So that the question you're asking is precisely the question that you're meant to be asking, which is like, how do we contend with the way in which capital and the logic of capital has infiltrated into everything? Because we're not all living in the exact same, you know, we don't work in this coal field and then go right back to the same tenement, right? Like, life has been made more complex. And the point of this, you know, the point of the slogan, right, the point of the theory is to assert that complexity as a problem of capitalism.
Yeah, yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. I think you're right. But I think maybe I would even put a finer point on it, in that we have to have a strategic inroad into, like, how do we get from here to there, from this where we stand right now to that horizon. To put a point on it, we have to be strategic about how do we get from here to there, right? From where we stand currently to that utopian horizon that we're placing in front of ourselves, that we're calling into existence by demanding a right to the city. We're saying that our right to the spaces that we live in supersedes the right of developers and banks to their property that they own and purchase. That strategic focus demands of us to hone in, to say that, you know, homeowners have to take a back seat. And I think, frankly, that neighborhood councils have to take a back seat to things like organizing tenants' unions that will have a lasting residual existence beyond particular demands. Have the ability, we need to conjure into existence a thing that never existed before, in the same way that the early labor movement was conjuring labor unions into existence. We need to conjure tenants unions into existence. And I think that that is exactly the strategic focus that we need to have today. And those organizations can sort of propel us into wider, you know, spheres of the life outside of the workplace and into the city or whatever. But that is the structure that very, like, you could have a municipal law, you could have a city law passed that says that landlords have to negotiate with tenant unions, and then you could organize the tenants in a given set of apartment complexes and then have them pay dues into a union that has staff that organizes further apartment complexes and expands outward from there, but has a lasting structure of of working class organization, of non-propertied disinvested individuals. And I think secondary to that would be things like mirroring the sort of the unemployed councils by organizing houseless people. I think that that one's a lot more difficult and a lot more demanding, and has a lot less leverage in existing society. But I think that that also has a higher precedent than simple neighborhood councils. That said, there is one countervailing consideration to that, which is that neighborhood councils have very real political power in existing state structures. Like, if you take over your local neighborhood council, you and your like band of like 5-10 people, friends that who live in your neighborhood, you could literally start showing up to neighborhood council meetings and neighborhood association meetings, take it over, and the city council will likely take very seriously recommendations that you confer to them.
So Lefebvre's conception of organization of the city is one in which all these sorts of things that you've been talking about, like basically creating a situation of dual power, and in which the organizations of the people eventually just supplant the organizations of the bourgeois city structure. And he kind of envisions it as sort of like a bloodless revolution where the organization of the people just makes the existing city organizations just superfluous and that they go away, you know? And I don't see that as happening, you know?
Yeah.
I mean,
same here.
It's interesting because Lefebvre is obviously a Marxist who considered himself a Leninist and took a lot from state and revolution, but maybe not so much the smash the state part, which I found to be interesting. Tell me if I read this wrong, because that book was pretty dense, but he sees the existence of the idea that the working class needs a vanguard party to seize control of the state or to smash the state and build new institutions as being part of being the problem that led to Stalinism, and sees a model in taking over neighborhood councils and taking over building new machinery to recapture the city as being the way to move forward.
I mean, I don't think that's wrong. I think that, like, Lefebvre, I mean, again, it's the historical context matters a lot. He's like Debord, and actually they knew each other and were personally close for a while.
Yeah, I got a strong Debord feel from reading Lefebvre talk about.
Yeah. You know, there are some people like C.L.R. James and Dostoevskaya in the States, and probably in every country, right? There are people who are trying to conceptualize a road around the dead end of the bureaucratized labor movement. And I think, you know, these people all overcorrected in that regard.
Right.
You know,
that's understandable.
Like, they're like, you know, I mean, especially we think about, like, 1968 proves in his mind that the generalized struggle of the class against capitalist alienation, which means that at the Renault factory, it's workers seizing the plant, and at the university, it's students occupying the university, and in the streets it's the people against the police, right? And that there's a generalized, like, that the whole urban space is as a representative of capital's power and accumulation, but also a representative of your lack of control over your own life. But it is also, again, it's a terrain of struggle across from one, you know, element to the next, is the place for the revolt. Like, it's proven there. But then also to somebody like Lefebvre, I think the unions and the Communist Party play the role of getting workers back to work, getting people off the streets, tearing down the barricades, and going to an election. So he sees,
right.
He sees two really important phenomena. And, you know, he's like, well, obviously we can see a road, right, that 68 proves something of this vision, and that the roadblock is the workers' movement itself. He's not entirely wrong. I just think we have a, I don't know what you want to call it, the benefit, right? We live in such a horrific time in which, wouldn't it be nice if our biggest problem was that the Communist Party was powerful enough to turn back a revolution and that we had to deal with that?
Right.
So, like, you know, I think that, yeah, I think you're right. Like, Lefebvre's like an insurrectionist, and he kind of rejects the political assumptions of Marxism as it relates to organization up to that point. I don't think we have to, but I think that his, yeah. I think his assessment.
I wasn't going to.
Yeah, good. I think his assessment of urbanization and the way that it relates to capital's expansion and continued viability, which is the same as Harvey's, right? Like, he identifies like a big part of the growth engine of capital in the post-war era, like maintaining the wartime boom, in deregulating, city planning, you know?
Yeah.
You know, this is why like Los Angeles and Dallas and Atlanta and Houston and all of the big cities in the United States today, they all follow a similar model of development, which is chaotic and sprawling, defies all
the
reason.
Worst.
And it is the worst, right?
It's the literal worst.
Like, I think we could say that they're right, but that so do we still need a mass socialist party, which actually is the only way that I think we can answer the question of, like, how do you stitch together all of these disparate pieces into a cohesive vision that can actualize the right to the city beyond just being an interesting slogan for, like, a city government to use to, like, you know, appropriate certain amount of credits for low-income housing in a gentrifying neighborhood. You know, like,
right.
Like any slogan, like any right, it can be recuperated. It can be turned against us. The organization of the class on political lines in the party form or in something like that is, I think, still a proven necessity.
Hey everyone, just a reminder that we now have a Patreon. As for now, it's going to stay at $2 and it will just have whatever we feel like throwing up there, and it won't be in any regular fashion. Hopefully we'll be able to become more regular with our exclusive content, and then maybe at that point we will create a second tier with all the really good stuff on it. But for now, there's one tier, it's $2, go ahead and go sign up. Also, like us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, and please remember to rate, subscribe, and review us on iTunes so that more people can find us. And as always, please just share our stuff with your friends. And if you've got ideas of things that you would like to hear us talk about, go ahead and send us a private message on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram. All right, back to the episode. So, one of the things that I did like about Lefebvre was his conceptualization of urbanizing as being something that was totalizing. Like, it's a the process of urbanization subjects the hinterlands and the countryside to the city. Like, the countryside does not exist without its interaction to the city, right? So that the land for hundreds and hundreds of miles in every direction around the city is essentially completely integrated to the life of the city and doesn't exist without it. He says that urbanization is a part of class society, and it has become sort of hyperactive under capitalism,
yeah,
and industrialization, and incredibly destructive and alienating, and has sped up all of the terrible things about class society. But one of the things that I liked about it is it makes me think of the project of base building, right? And
shout out to us once again.
it makes me think of the project of base building, and we're trying to conceive of ways in which we can have the most impact. And, you know, Kevin's talking about, tenants unions, and we're talking about neighborhood councils, and we're talking about all these things that we can become involved in order to build a constituency among the working class, right? And the way to have the greatest impact upon the, you know, our regions, our areas at large, and it, to conceive of, it, it makes it easier to conceive of our impact on the wider society, right? If so, if we can have an impact in one part of the city, it will radiate outwards because of the interconnected nature of the countryside to the city.
Yeah.
So it's like being able to think about things in that manner is important, because for most of my life, whenever I think of, you know, the future revolution, it's almost impossible for me to conceive of, right? But being able to understand the city and being able to understand the interconnectedness of city and countryside helps with that, especially when we're talking about concrete ways to move forward.
No, I think that's, I mean, it's the same, right? Like, I feel like my political trajectory for the last 9 years started in a way that was not conscious to me, but started with grappling with this question. And it's why I keep returning to the Bolivarian Revolution and of Venezuela as being, like, I think it was rightly a point of reference around the world when it looked to be on the advance. And I think it is now, especially in, like, the more critical parts of, like, you know, what we could call the Western left, or, like, the left in the global north, it's also under-theorized, right? It's just, like, it looked like it was good because people were on the move, right? But there are, like, really important questions about state and revolution that are raised by it. And one of them is urban space. And the way in which, like, so, like, Gezi Park, the movement of the squares, the Arab Spring, Occupy Wall Street, they all continually, you know, raise the thesis again and again about the city, about the urban. The Belt and Road Initiative and, you know, the hyper infrastructural, well, like, hell, the Justice and Development Party that rules Turkey, like, the way in which capital rules when it's at its most effective is infrastructural. It's development capital. Like, this question gets raised a bunch of times. But it's only in a couple of places we actually start to see something of an answer. And it happens to be, like, on the rowdiest section of the Brazilian left, you know, not the PT, sections of the Brazilian left, which are to the left of the PT. You know, that have, you know, raised this question of the neighborhood, of financing, of, like, taking back finance for the development of the neighborhood along the lines demanded by the people there, or in Venezuela, where they actually developed forms of organization which got incorporated into the state. It's really been, like, for me, a way of actually conceiving of revolution in the 21st century, in a way which is not a, like, a, you know, deranged nostalgic fantasy about, like, what if it was like 1917, but again, because as soon as you start to think about things
cooler,
right, but again and cooler.
When I think about controlling, having real control over the highways, I think about ripping them up and replacing them with fucking, like, high-speed rail.
That's exactly like right. That.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You can see the inhuman nature of capital every time you drive somewhere. You can see that's what it looks like when they develop the city. But what would it look like when we develop the city?
And I think this really gets to the heart of, like, Harvey talking about leftists not actually doing a good job of talking about infrastructure at all. Mm-hmm. Like, we do a good job of, like, giving a nod to it when talking about how underfunded infrastructure is and all of that. But we don't actually grapple with it in any meaningful way. And I don't think that this is the language that I want to use, but I don't know how else to put it. Like, I think that it requires us to think of, like, organizing offensively instead of defensively, right? Which is hard to say because under capitalism, like, everything is defensively because the system is, like, constantly attacking us. But so much of those attacks take place outside of the workplace, right? So what does it mean? So, like, throwback to talking about, like, base building, which, you know, I had been trying to kind of like circle back around, not just to like shout out our episode on base building, but because I think these things actually go hand in hand, right? Like, what does it mean to actually have something in place in terms of like workers' defense or like community defense, which like now usually means scrambling. So for like, especially in South Texas, when we're talking about immigration, and like the constant threat of deportation, right? But also other things that come to mind when we talk about like community defense that are not, that, you know, everything's tied to production, right? In some way, but like are not necessarily, you know, exclusively workplace struggles. So like school closures and like libraries being, like defunding libraries, right? Like our parks are all being sold right now in our city. So, I don't know. There's a lot of things that come to mind. Like, what does it mean to actually have something in place? And not have to constantly, organize from a place of defense. You know, I think that, you know, Harvey talks a lot about, you know, there being, kind of people playing with these ideas of like building community defense. But you know, so many of these like solidarity networks exist like Red Crosses, and they're not actually politicized. And the people who are politicized, right, aren't actually doing this
work. Just charity
and yeah, tying it to our politics. Right. So, I mean, like, obviously these are all ideas that are like completely half baked on my part, and certainly on the broader left's part, but, you know, I'm just, like, trying to think about how this conversation ties in with this conversation of how the conversation about base building, you know, fits into this conversation that we're having right now.
Well, something that I've been thinking about a lot, just to say briefly, that I don't think that there is really anything that the left is concerned with or should be concerned with that is under-theorized. There are a great many things that are under-engaged with.
Actualized?
People need to... Yeah, under-actualized. Exactly. Thank you. Yeah. Fucking put the book down and go do something. Go talk to your neighbors. Go talk to your coworkers. Build relationships with other human beings and organize, do something in the actual world.
I mean, I disagree. I think, I mean, obviously I don't disagree that you should, like, go talk to your neighbors and do something in the actual world. I disagree that there's nothing that's under-theorized. I would even posit that most practical things that actually we should talk to our neighbors about are under-theorized.
So I would agree that there are a number of things that are under-theorized. The problem is I think they are over-theorized by people who aren't doing the work. And, like, that theory is not actually being informed by praxis. Like, we're just throwing shit at the wall and seeing what sticks, which is what organizing is. Like, that's how we learn, right? You learn and struggle. We love to say that. But I don't know that... I don't have, this isn't a call out. I'm not saying that like the people who are talking about these things aren't doing shit. I don't know who's doing what, but it does feel suspect.
So it sounds like what Kevin is calling for is more voluntarism.
Yeah.
Look, I think that the left is theoretically, in this country, theoretically deficient. And I'm counting myself as an inheritor of that tradition. Like, when we talk about theory, what we think we mean by theory is learning history through a particular lens, right? But like, we jumped ahead in this conversation, for example, over the development of capital and capital's project over the last several decades, right to how can we practically apply the questions. But I think that there's a tendency on our part to do that for a reason, because that's actually what we've been trained to do. So like let's go and actualize the right to the city. It's like, well, hold on, what do we even mean by that? I think I think we have to mean more than we need tenants' unions and also unions at work, right? Like, there has to be a whole lot more to it than that. Like, when we're trying to contend with the fact that, like, there's no sphere of existence that's free from commodification and the domination of capital, like, that's an enormous thing to try to get our heads around. We could probably all stand us and talk about it more. The thing is that we then also have to, like, you know, put it into practice and try to guess and fail and recompose whatever. But I actually do want to reject to some extent, the vulgarized version of we learn in struggle. Because I think that we haven't learned very much in struggle in a way that's important for building class organization. We've had decades of movement, but the question of political organization is basically we hit the hard reset. We don't have any idea what kind of organization we need as a class. So, when Harvey talks about, like, the way in which class organization tends to mirror the configurations of capital. So we go from, like, the Fordist hyper-concentrated points of production and their corresponding big centralized parties and unions over to the neoliberal era where we have the decentralized configurations of capital and the corresponding, like, horizontalist, you know, mutual aid networks and, you know, rejection of the party form. And in both cases, what we've done is we've provided a mirror of society back. We absorbed the logic of capital's configuration into our resistance to it. What would it look like for us to reconfigure the left in a way which didn't just respond, but actually, you know, like you said before, Jenny, went on the offensive against the configurations of capital. I have no idea. I think that requires a bit of theorization.
Well, and it requires an imagination and some creativity that the left is, like...
Right, I agree with
desperately,
that.
Like, deficient of right now.
Yeah.
It's hard to build an imagination when you are tailing existing social movements as the only method of organizing.
Yeah, right. Mm. So, like, okay. So... To say go out and do something is not to say go out and do anything, right?
Do everything.
You have to, like, there has to be a...
Fight a trash can.
Yeah, exactly. Like, they're clear, like, so you have to have some sort of theoretical analysis that gives you a perspective that says this is a better thing to do than that. You know, my assertion earlier that we need to have... a very serious strategic focus on tenants' unions rather than just, you know, occupying your local park or whatever. So
I'm against
that. I mean, me too. And that's, I arrive at that conclusion because I've sat around and I've thought about it and I've read articles by smart people talking about it. But what I'm saying is that we have no dearth, at least relative to the size of the left, we have no dearth of four-eyed eggheads sitting around thinking about the right to the city, but we do
kettle pot.
Look, the people listening right now, they don't know that you have glasses.
Yeah, I know. and a very egg-shaped head. Yeah.
And you're white.
And, yeah,
a graduate degree.
They know he's white.
But
they
we do have a dearth of, a dramatic dearth of, are leftists who have a fucking relationship with their neighbor, much less could go around and talk to their apartment, all of the neighbors in their apartment building, and make a collective demand on their landlord.
That's
what I'm talking about.
That's not wrong, but it's also the first part's also wrong, I think. Like, I'm pushing back hard against the idea that we have, like, an overabundance of theory. I actually think we have a dearth of theory. Absolutely.
In my experience, we've got an overabundance of people that are excited to just fucking do something.
Yeah.
So they do something until they burn out and they disappear.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I would say that the growth engine of DSA is ignore theory, go out and do the work.
Yeah,
and that's
the only reason that I'm still
at some point.
The only reason that I'm still here, or that I'm back, anyway, in some fucking capacity, is because of the goddamn theory, you know? I did 10 years worth of, like, tailism and a hyperactive fucking voluntarism, and it got me absolutely nowhere, except for, like, more misanthropic than I previously was. But it's, yeah, I don't know. It's like if Jesus is in your heart, you know, you'll always come back. You know what I mean?
It's pretty similar to that. But here's where I will kind of concede your point, Kevin. I think, like, what we need is, again, these are not questions for individuals.
Theory and
there's an idea. No, look, like, these aren't questions. This is not a conversation for individuals. We have an overabundance of, on the one hand, social movements completely loosed from the moorings of theory. And on the other hand, we have the academy, right? Which surely there are at least hundreds, maybe even thousands of people who have read a David Harvey essay and have said the words "Right to the City" and even maybe written them in a term paper somewhere. When I talk about theory, what I mean is that, like, when we do a socialist day schools in our movement, what if we did it on this? Right? Like, the political economy of the cities we live in, so for me, Los Angeles, and you know, somebody else somewhere else, right? And then practical questions and, you know, some history lessons about the methods of and models of resistance which have dealt with those things up to this point. And then, yes, theorizing in the abstract about what we might be able to do based on lessons we've learned. And we stopped doing a whole lot of what passes for theory, which is like, my interpretation of Soviet history is better than yours, or my interpretation of the history of social democracy is better than yours, because it might be, but I don't think it actually teaches us anything. That's what I mean when I say
I like doing that stuff too,
though. Yeah, I mean, I want to do those things, but I think that those things need to get relegated to the book clubs, and this sort of thing needs to get promoted to, like, everyone do this reading, everyone figure out, everyone argue about how this relates to the practical world.
So I don't think that we know how to theorize.
Yeah, that's
a good
point. Does
that make sense? Like, okay. I know that's a very simple
all
sentence.
Right, fair.
No, it's right, though.
Yeah, that's fair.
Like, we have learned how to, in some capacity, like, interpret existing theory. For better or worse, right or wrong, I don't know that we have actually, in any meaningful way, figured out how to theorize. And I think that's what has left us spinning in circles about the work that we should be doing. Because, you know, in a lot of ways, I echo the whole, like, do the work bullshit, because I feel that in my heart of hearts. But I don't think in doing that work, the people who are doing it are equipped enough to theorize about, like, next steps.
I think this is an interesting conversation.
It's more interesting than I expected it to be.
Does the left know how to theorize? And, like, I think the short answer is no, not really. I mean, like, yeah, I think that's the legacy of Stalinism and the responses to it, like
Trotskyism.
Yeah.
Anarchism and Maoism.
It's almost like we should do a whole episode on that.
So I think the best example that of what you're saying is Maoism in the United States. Like, the existence of Maoism in the United States. Maoism was a specific form of national liberation with red flags that very much was geared towards the liberation of China from Japanese and American and British and everyone else's influence, using a peasant army which modernized China and built up forces of production and turned it into a modern state which has some vaguely socialistic characteristics, right? And somehow Americans thought, oh, well, that's what we need here.
So what are we really saying, right? We're saying, like, value is produced in the labor process, but realized in the market. So,
right.
The way that we're trying to theorize of having a fighting chance as a class is that we need a socialist movement which tries to organize workers as such at the workplace, but also tries to organize the working population more generally, in the home, in the neighborhood, in the city. We need to recognize that our lifestyles are determined by the form.
Death styles.
Fuck. Our lifestyles are determined by the form of urbanization. And that, capital dictates the way that we live. And so that, like, to theorize and actualize revolutionary practice in the 21st century means to try to establish a horizon which is much further than the day-to-day struggles which we need to actually engage in. So that, Kevin, you're right. We need to be able to go door to door and talk to our neighbors. And actually, like, that should be the model of socialist organization, should be at the neighborhood level, right? Because we should have a corresponding model of organization for what we actually theorize as our desires. Not a citywide activist club and not purely a workplace-based, model of organization either. The way we're going to realize the Green New Deal or some much more far-reaching, societal approach to climate change, it's going to be because, like Jenny, like you pointed out, there are people who have the direct experience of resisting the effects of capital's ability to remake our urban space around us. And to generalizing that to the level of theory, there's a kind of leftist that thinks we've talked too much and have over-theorized alienation generally, and that we haven't talked enough about power at the workplace. I think that the point is that...
Sorry, I don't know why I thought that was so funny.
It was. The point is that, like, the scattered remnants of the last several lefts, they're all working in things in isolation from each other. But, like, if we're going to effectively challenge capitalist power, we have to be able to do it everywhere.
It's not even just work or the commute. It is those things, right? But it's also the amount of time we spend out of work just trying to prepare ourselves to be able to exist at work the following day. To, like, replenish ourselves to be able to exist in this fucking world. That so much of our actual leisure time isn't spent, like, out and about enjoying our cities or lives. It's spent just trying to recuperate to be ready to face another fucking day, at the office or wherever.
Think about what even qualifies as public space. It's mostly like shopping centers or some version of what was once mm-hmm. public space, which is mediated by commerce, and it's only like a pseudo public space.
Right, like these new shopping centers, or not shopping centers, these new developments that are popping up that'll be like a square in the middle of a bunch of apartments, like multi-story apartments that all have shops mm-hmm. in the bottom floor, mm-hmm. So that it's like a little self-contained private park that's surrounded by things that you can consume that is only for the people that actually live in the buildings or shop in the stores.
Right, it's like it takes the town square, the image of the town square, and it repackages it as a shopping center that you live in so that the loop is closed and you can actually visualize the lack of the closing space between the point of production and the point of realization. Especially if you work at home, you're literally working in the place where you're going to consume. And, when Harvey talks about 30, he says, I don't know exactly how he calculates this because I'm not familiar enough with all of his work. He says consumerism makes up 30% of the global economy and 70% of the U.S. economy. And I suppose what he means by that is the point of realization, right, which is, what capital volume 2 is all about. accounts for a more significant portion of the economy, right, than we even allow ourselves to acknowledge. So the reason to have a conversation about the right to the city is, let's say, to reduce it to purely economic terms for the value theorists out there. You just can't fully understand and thus can't fully respond to capitalism in the way that it's configured today without having a corresponding, without having a critique of the point of realization. And it's an overdetermination.
No sound is heard from Unit 2, where there was once so much to do. It was once a green mansion, and now it's a wasteland. Our days of breakfast.